Random House Audio presents Star Wars, The New Jedi Order, Traitor, by Matthew Stover, read for you by Jonathan Davis. Outside the universe, there is nothing. This nothing is called hyperspace. A tiny bubble of existence hangs in the nothing. This bubble is called a ship. The bubble is its own universe. Outside the universe, there is nothing. Jason Solo hangs in the white, exploring the spectrum of pain. In the far infrared, he finds cinders of thirst that bake his throat. Higher, up in the visible wavelengths, gleam the crimson wire-stretched ligaments that sizzle within his shoulders. Grinding glass shard screams howl from his hip joints, like the death shrieks of golden Ithorian starflowers. And higher still, now far beyond the ultraviolet betrayal that brought him here, the betrayal that delivered him into the hands of the Yuuzhan Vong, the betrayal that gathered him into the embrace of pain, the betrayal by Verger, whom he had trusted, he finds silent, shattering gamma-ray bursts sleeting into his brain. Those gamma-ray bursts are the color of his brother's death. Anakin, he moans, somewhere deep within himself. Anakin, how can you be dead? Jason cannot remember if he is on a ship or still planet-bound. He remembers that he's been captured before. He remembers Belkadan, remembers his vain dream of freeing slaves, remembers the blank terror of discovering that his force powers meant nothing against the Yuuzhan Vong. He remembers the embrace of pain, remembers his rescue by Uncle Luke, Master Luke, Master Skywalker. He remembers Verger. Remembering Verger brings him to the Voxen Queen, and the Voxen Queen sends him slithering back down a despair-greased slope to Anakin's corpse. Jason knows, intellectually, distantly, abstractly, that once he lived outside the white. He knows that he once felt happiness, pleasure, regret, anger, even love. But these are only ghosts, shadows murmuring beneath the roar of pain that fills everything he is, everything he will ever be. The simple fact that the white had a beginning does not imply that it will have an end. Jason exists beyond time. Where Jason is, there is only the white and the Force. Jason has become a prism, reintegrating the glittering spectrum of pain into pure, blazing agony. Agony is white. Snowblind in an eternal Hoth ice noon of suffering, Jason Solo hangs in the embrace of pain. The touch of a hand along his jaw leaked time into the white. The tides of agony rolled slowly out, and Jason could open his eyes. The hand that had brought him out of the white belonged to Verger. She stood below him, looking up with wide alien eyes, her fingers light upon his cheek. Jason hung horizontally, suspended face down 2 meters above a floor of wet, slick-looking greens and browns, its surface corded, viny, as though with muscle and vein. From the darkness above swung tentacles like prehensile eye stalks, ends socketed with glowing orbs that stared at him as the tentacles wove and danced and twisted about each other. He understood. The enemy was watching.
Among our masters, Verger said casually, as though continuing a friendly conversation,
It is not considered shameful for a warrior in your position to pray for death. Do you understand this? Jason understood nothing, except how much he hurt and how terribly he had been betrayed.
I trusted you.
Yes, you did. She opened her hand, turning her quadrifid palm upward, as if to catch a falling tear, and smiled up at him. Why? Jason could not find his breath to give answer, and then he found he had no answer to give. She was so alien. Body compact and lithe, arms long and oddly mobile, as though possessed of extra joints, hands from which fingers opened like the gripping spines of Andoan rock polyps, back-bent knees above splay-toed feet. He was acutely, overpoweringly aware that he had never seen any of Vergère's kind before. Long, bright eyes the shape of teardrops, a spray of whiskers curving around a wide, expressive mouth. But expressive of what? How could he know what the arc of her lips truly signified?
I thought you were on our side.
One whiskered eyebrow arched.
There is no our side, Jason Solo.
What do you want from me? Why have you done this? Why are you here?
Deep questions, little Solo.
Her ridge feathers rippled through a shimmering rainbow, like a diamond-edged sabacc deck riffled by an expert dealer.
It is near enough to the truth to say that I am a messenger of melancholy, a herald of tragedy, bearing gifts to ease the grieved, a mourner with grave goods to decorate the tomb, a hierophant to perform the sacred offices for the dead.
Jason's head swam.
You're saying...
Jason licked his lips, his tongue so dry it scraped them raw.
You're saying... You're going to kill me.
Oh, no. Not at all. I'm saying you're already dead.
Jason stared.
You are forever lost to the world you knew,
she went on with a liquidly alien gesture that might have been a shrug.
Your friends mourn. Your father rages. Your mother weeps. The bright fields of day are forever past.
Jason opened himself to the Force, let its clean cascade wash through him, dissolving his pain and confusion, and found at his side a connection to the Force as profound as his own. Vergère crackled with power. Jason murmured,
You're a Jedi.
Vergère laughed.
There are no Jedi here,
she said, and made a gesture, eye flick swift. Beyond that, he heard and saw no more. A silent supernova erupted within Jason's brain and blasted away the universe. Seconds, or centuries, passed in oblivion. Consciousness swam back into him, and he opened his eyes to find himself still hanging in the embrace of pain, Vergère still standing below him, on her face the same alien facsimile of cheerful mockery. Nothing had changed. Everything had changed. The universe was empty now.
What?
Jason croaked, his throat raw as though he'd spent days screaming in his sleep.
What have you done to me?
You have no business with the Force, nor it with you. Let you have the Force? The idea. No, 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 little Solo. The Force is much too dangerous for children, so I took it away from you.
The emptiness of the universe howled inside his head. There was nothing out there, only vast interstellar vacuum.
You... there's no way. You can't possibly.
But I have. Really, this Force business, you're better off without it. If you're a good boy, I'll give it back when you grow up.
But I'm a Jedi.
You were a Jedi, she corrected him. Haven't you been paying attention? What part about being dead do you not understand?
I don't.
Jason's eyes drifted closed.
Jason Solo, listen well.
Her voice was warm and kind, and her breath smelt of spices grown in alien soil.
Everything I tell you is a lie. Every question I ask is a trick. You will find no truth in me.
Jason stared into eyes as blackly encompassing as interstellar space. He whispered,
What are you?
I am Vergère. What are you?
She waited, motionlessly patient, as though to confirm that he had no answer. Then she turned away. A hatch sphincter dilated in the wall. A wet sound like lips opening for a kiss, and Vergère left without a backward glance. The walls and ceiling creaked like an old man's joints as the grip of the embrace of pain tightened again. Jason Solo was once more swallowed by agony. Jason Solo hangs in the white, thinking. He has begun to riddle out the lesson of pain. The white drops him once in a while, as though the embrace of pain understands him somehow, as though it can read the limit of his strength. Sometimes, when he slips down from the white, Vergère is there. Once he asked in his thin, weakly croaking voice, How long? She made the liquid ripple of her flexible arms that he usually took for a shrug.
How long you have been here is as irrelevant as where you are. Time and place belong to the living, little Solo. They have nothing to do with you, nor you with them.
His questions always meet with answers like this one. Eventually, he stops asking. Questions require strength, and he has none to spare.
Our masters serve stern gods, she said,
the second or fifth or tenth time he awoke to find her at his side.
The true gods decree that life is suffering and give us pain to demonstrate their truth. Do you understand this yet?
Vergère seemed never to care if he didn't answer. She seemed perfectly content to prattle away endlessly on any random subject, as though interested in nothing beyond the sound of her own voice. But if he so much as lifted his head, as soon as he croaked an answer or murmured a question, the subject somehow turned to pain. They had plenty to talk about. Jason had learned a great deal about pain. His first actual clue to the lesson of pain came once when he lay upon the corded floor, trembling with exhaustion. The branch-like grips of the embrace of pain still held him, but loosely, maintaining contact no more. More to distract himself than out of any desire for conversation, he had rolled over to face Vergère and asked,
Why are you doing this to me?
This? Vergère gazed at him steadily. What am I doing?
No.
He closed his eyes, organizing pain-scattered thoughts, then opened them again.
No, I mean the Yuuzhan Vong, the embrace of pain. I've been through a breaking. The breaking makes a kind of sense, I guess. But this...
His voice broke despairingly, but he caught himself and held his tongue until he could control it. Despair is of the dark side.
Why are they torturing me?
He asked, clearly and simply.
Perhaps you are not being tortured, she said cheerily. Perhaps you are being taught.
Oh, sure. What's this supposed to teach me?
Is it what the teacher teaches? Vergère countered. Or what the student learns?
What's the difference?
The arc of her lips and the angle of her head might have added up to a smile.
That is itself a question worth considering, yes?
There was another time, before, after, he could never be sure. Vergère crouched at his side, and as consciousness trickled through him, he seemed to recall that she had been coaxing him to take a sip from the stem of an elongated gourd-like drink bulb. "What is pain for?" she murmured after a time. "Do you ever think about that, Jason Solo? What is its function? The most basic instinct of life is to retreat from pain, to hide from it. If going here hurts, even a granite slug will go over there. To live is to be a slave to pain. To be beyond pain is to be dead, yes?"
"Not for me," Jason answered dully, once his throat opened enough that he could speak. "No matter how dead you say I am, it still hurts."
"Do you think that pain might be the ruling principle of death as well?"
"I don't think anything. I just want it to stop."
"I am such a fool," she chimed. "All this time I had thought I was speaking to an adult. Ah, self-deception is the cruelest trick of all, isn't it? I let myself believe that you had once been a true Jedi, when in truth you are only a hatchling, shivering in the nest, squalling because your mother hasn't fluttered up to feed you."
Jason lowered his head, struggling against sudden hot tears.
"I must go now. The embrace has become impatient for your return."
She put her hand between the lips of the mouth-like sensor receptacle beside the hatch sphincter, and the warted pucker of the hatch gaped wide.
"Everything I tell you is a lie," she said, and stepped through.
The embrace of pain gathered him once more into the white. Jason Solo hangs in the white, thinking. He spends a white eon marveling. Pain is itself a god, the taskmaster of life. Pain cracks the whip, and all that lives will move. To live is to be a slave to pain. But that is only half true. Pain can also be a teacher. Jason can remember hour after hour of dragging his aching muscles through one more repetition of his lightsaber training routines. He remembered Uncle Luke saying, "If it doesn't hurt, you're not doing it right." Sometimes pain is the only bridge to where you want to go. And the worst pains are the ones you can't run away from anyway. He knows his mother's tale so well that he has seen it in his dreams, standing on the bridge of the Death Star, forced to watch while the battle station's main weapon destroyed her entire planet. Pain can be power, too, Jason realizes. Power to change things for the better. That's how change happens. Someone hurts, and sooner or later decides to do something about it. Suffering is the fuel in the engine of civilization. Now he begins to understand. Because pain is a god, he has been in the grip of this cruel god ever since Anakin's death. But it is also a teacher and a bridge. It can be a slave master and break you, and it can be the power that makes you unbreakable. It is all these things and more at the same time. What it is depends on who you are. But who am I? There's only one way to find out. For indefinite days, weeks, centuries, the white has been eating him. Now he begins to eat the white. Executor Gnome Anor toyed idly with a sackworm of dragweed broth while he waited for the Shaper drone to finish its report. He sat human-style on a fleshy hump to one side of the unusually large villip, to which the drone addressed its monotonous sing-song analysis of the Embrace Chamber's readings on the young Jedi, Jason Solo. With vegetative accuracy, the villip conveyed the physical features of the War Master. His tall, narrow skull, bulging brain case, dangerously sharp teeth, bristling within his lipless gash of a mouth, as well as the proud array of scars that defined his devotion to the true way. The Vilip also captured perfectly the frightening intensity of Savang La's fanatic glare. The War Master was a true believer. To know Manor, faith was an extravagance. He knew too well how easily such true believers can be manipulated by those who believe in nothing but themselves. The moment he'd been waiting for came during the drone's exhaustive point-by-point cross-species interpolation between Jason Solo's readings and those of three different control subjects, all Yuuzhan Vong. One warrior caste, one priest caste, and one shaper caste, each of whom had earlier undergone excruciation by the very same embrace of pain in which the young Jedi now hung. Anger gathered upon Savang La's Vilip image, like the ion peak that precedes a solar flare. Finally, his patience broke.
Why is my time wasted with this babble?
Noma Nor exchanged one quick glance with the other occupant of the chamber, his partner in the Solo project, then directed his gaze back to the Vilip.
The import of the Embrace Chamber's data is exactly this. Jason Solo has become capable of not only accepting torment, but thriving on it. As the War Master will recall, I predicted such a result. He has discovered resources within himself of the sort that we find only in our greatest warriors. And, the War Master glared, make your point. It will work, Noma Nor said simply. That is the point, the only point. Based on our current figures, Jason Solo will inevitably, provided he lives, turn to the true way with his whole heart. You still have not made clear why I should desire this. The symbolic importance of Jason Solo cannot be overestimated, War Master. First, he is Jedi, and the Jedi stand in place of gods in the New Republic. They are looked to as surrogate parents, gifted with vast abilities that legend further magnifies beyond all reason. Their purpose is to fight and die for the New Republic's debased infidel perversions of truth and justice. Jason Solo is already a legendary hero. Jason Solo is also the eldest son of the galaxy's leading clan. His mother was, for a time, the New Republic's supreme overlord.
Their politics are your concern, Savang La growled. Their fighting strength is mine.
The two are, in this case, more closely related than the War Master might suspect.
For a quarter of a standard century, the Solo family has dominated galactic affairs of all kinds. Even the War Master of the Jedi is none other than Jason Solo's uncle. This uncle, Luke Skywalker, is popularly considered to have single-handedly created the New Republic by defeating an older, much more rational government called the Empire. And I might add, it is fortunate for us that he did. The Empire was vastly more organized, powerful, and potently militaristic. Lacking the internal divisions we have exploited so successfully in the New Republic, the Empire could have crushed our people utterly in their first encounter. Savang La bristled.
The true gods would never have allowed such a defeat.
Precisely my point, Noma Nor countered. They didn't. Instead, Luke Skywalker, the Solos, and the Rebel Alliance destroyed the Empire, leaving the galaxy in a state of disarray, a power vacuum that we could exploit. For even then, the Solo clan served the true gods without ever knowing it.
For the first time, Savang La began to look interested.
Now imagine, Noma Nor said, scenting blood, the effect on the morale of the remaining New Republic forces when this Jedi, this hero, this scion of the greatest clan of their entire civilization announces to all his people that they have been deceived by their leaders, that the true gods,
are the only gods. That the true way is the only way.
The Vilip conveyed perfectly a spark kindling in the War Master's eyes.
You are certain that you can make Jason Solo submit to the truth?
War Master, Nomanor said intensely. It is already happening. Jason and Jaina Solo are twins, yet male and female, complementary opposites. Don't you see it? Yun Yamka and Yun Harla, warrior and trickster. Jason Solo will become one half of the twin gods, to fight in service of the god he is. He will be proof no creature of the New Republic could ever refute.
The spark in the War Master's eyes suddenly blazed into a fusion furnace.
The great sacrifice. You speak of the sacrifice of the twins.
Yes. You yourself, War Master, must have wondered in your heart of hearts, must have doubted the true god's promise of victory when the final sacrifice could not be performed.
Yes.
And so, on that great day, Jason Solo will himself capture his sister, his twin. He will drag her to the altar, and he will himself take her life in the great twin sacrifice. And the will of the true gods shall finally be brought to pass.
The true gods' will be done,
Savang La thundered.
The true gods' will be done, Nomanor agreed.
You will do this.
Yes, War Master.
You will not fail.
If it be within my power, War Master.
No!
You do not understand. I tell you, Nomanor, you will not fail.
The true gods are not mocked.
Should Jason Solo not turn to the true path, no breath of this can be whispered. No hint of this can be thought. For Nomanor, there is only victory. Lacking victory, the creature that is currently called by the name Nomanor shall be sacrificed to the true gods as a nameless thing.
Abruptly, the Vilip inverted to its quiescent state, folding in upon itself with wet slaps like raw meat smacking bone. Nomanor sat back and discovered that he was trembling. He turned to the other occupant of the small chamber.
We are, as the Corellians say, off to a flying start.
Across the quiescent Vilip, his partner met his gaze with unblinking avian calm.
Well begun, Vergere said neutrally. Is half done.
Jason opened his eyes as the hatch sphincter dilated. Vergere stood outside. She did not seem inclined to enter.
You're looking well.
He shrugged and sat up.
How have you been enjoying your vacation from the Embrace? I see your wrists have healed. How do your shoulders feel? Your hips and ankles? Can you walk?
Jason shrugged again, looking down. He had lost track of how many times he had slept and awakened again since the embrace of pain had finally released him. Vergere tossed him a robe and extended a hand.
Arise, Jason Solo. Arise and walk.
He forced himself to his feet and slipped the robe over his head. He stepped through the hatch sphincter. The corridor had somehow changed. Instead of the resin-smooth, Yorick coral passageway he had glimpsed when Vergere would come or go, he now stood inside one end of a tunnel, or a tube. A pair of tall, impassive Yuuzhan Vong warriors stood outside in full Von Dune crab armor, right arms thick with the coils of their ampi-stamps. Jason looked back through the closing sphincter. He was leaving a lot of pain in that room. He was bringing a lot of pain with him. But pain didn't mean so much to him anymore. He fell in at Vergere's side as she stalked away along the slick, warm tunnel. It was valved like the inside of a vein. The warriors followed. Jason couldn't find the direction or a pattern in the route they walked, through endless tangles of fleshy tubes that seemed to branch and coil and knot themselves at random. Light filtered through the walls from outside, vividly illuminating striated arterial clusters in the tube's translucent skin. Valves before them opened at Vergier's touch, valves behind closed by themselves. Often they passed hatch sphincters, like the one that had sealed the embrace of pain. Sometimes these might be open, revealing chambers floored with grassy swamp, woody trunks branching above brownish muck, globular yawns draped with cocoons of alien pupae, or caverns vast and dark, where tiny flames of crimson and chartreuse, a vivid yellow or dim, almost invisible violet, floated and gleamed and winked like eyes of predators gathered in the night to watch prey huddle around a campfire. What is this place? Jason had been on Yuuzhan Vong's ships before, and he'd seen their planet-side installations at Belkadan. Sure, they had been organic, more grown than built, but they had been comprehensible. Is this a ship? A space station? Some kind of creature? It is all those and more. The Yuuzhan Vong name for this ship, station, creature, what you will, translates as seed ship. She pulled him close and lowered her voice as though sharing a private joke. This is an egg that will give birth to an entire world. Jason made a face like he tasted something foul. A Yuuzhan Vong world?
Of course.
I was on Belkadan, and Duro. There was nothing like this, to do their, what would you call it, Vong forming? They just sprayed gene-tailored bacteria into the atmosphere.
Belkadan and Duro are no more than industrial parks, Verger said. They are shipyards producing war material. They will be used up and abandoned. But the world transformed by this seed ship, it will be home.
Jason felt weak.
Home? A planet can be described as a single organism, a living creature with a skeleton of stone and a heart of molten rock. The species that inhabit a planet, plant and animal alike, from microbe to megalosis, are the planet creature's organs, internal symbionts and parasites. This seed ship itself is composed mostly of incubating stem cells, which will differentiate into living machines, which will in turn construct an entire planet's worth of wildlife with vastly accelerated growth. Animals will mature within a few standard days, whole forests within weeks. Mere months after seeding, the new world will bear a fully functioning, dynamically stable ecosystem. The replica of a planet dead for so many thousand years that it is barely a memory.
Their homeworld, Jason muttered. The Yuuzhan Vong. They're making themselves a new homeworld. That's what this is.
You might call it that.
Verger stopped and gestured to one of the warriors. She touched a spot on the tube skin. The warrior stepped forward and twitched his right arm. His amphistaff uncoiled into a blade that ripped a long, ragged slash through the wall. The lips of the slash seeped milky fluid. Verger pulled one lip aside as though holding open a curtain. Jason pushed through the gap, into air smotheringly thick with rot and excrement and hot, wet mold. The milky fluid blood from the gap trailed pale, sticky strings that clung to his hair and his hands. Then he looked up and forgot about the milk. He stood in a world turned inside out. The tunnel at his back made a knotted hump like a varicose vein across the crest of the hill. From up here, Jason had a clear vantage over a boil of swamp and jungle all the way to the horizon. But there was no horizon. Through storm swirls of stinking fog, an endless bowl of scum-stained pools and fetid belching quagmires rose higher and higher and higher until he had to squint against the actinic blue-white pinprick that was this place's sun. Then a rift parted the fog above, and he could see beyond the sun. Other swamps and jungles and ridges of low hills sealed shut the sky. Blurred in the regathering mist, it seemed that vast creatures roamed those hills in disorganized herds. But then the mist thinned again, and the scene snapped into perspective. Those creatures weren't huge. They were human. Not just human, but also Mon Calamari and Bothan and Twi'lek and dozens of other species. Those hills overhead were only a click away, maybe a click and a half. The sun must have been some kind of artificial fusion source, probably not much bigger than Jason's fist. Now he could pick out Yuuzhan Vong among the groups. Some warriors, not many, but hundreds and hundreds of what he guessed must be shapers, moving in slow and purposeful paths, taking soil and water samples, collecting leaves and strips of bark, stems and handfuls of algae, paying no attention at all to what he'd originally taken for herds. Those herds, those are slave gangs.
Magnificent, isn't it?
Verger said from beside him. Along the bank of a nearby bog, a crew dug savagely with crude shovels, howling as they threw muck and vegetation and dirt in all directions, trying to excavate what would have been probably some kind of drainage ditch, while another howling gang worked just as savagely to fill the ditch in once more. A little farther away, a knot of shouting, swearing people stuck grain cuttings into the mud, while a handful of others followed behind, moaning through streams of anguished tears while they stamped the cuttings flat. The sphere was filled with similar useless struggle, stone cairns being simultaneously built up and torn down, fields being packed flat with rolled stone while still being plowed, saplings being planted and chopped down, all by half-naked slaves staggering with exhaustion, some cursing, some sobbing, the rest only bellowing and shrieking wordless animal pain. This insanity. Jason hugged himself, swallowing hard, his breath shallow against the wretch that twisted his guts. How can you call this magnificent?
Because I see beyond what it is to what it shall become.
Her eyes danced.
But what is this place for?
Jason waved a hand at the pandemonium. What does this have to do with Vong forming a planet?
This?
Verger's head tilted in a way that Jason had learned to interpret as a smile.
This is a playground.
A playground?
Her gesture encompassed the entire sphere.
What you see around you is the work of powerful, undisciplined infants playing with their toys.
These aren't toys, Jason blurted, appalled. These are living beings, humans, Bothans.
I will not argue names with you, Jason Solo. Call them what you will. Their use remains the same.
What use? What possible value could anybody get out of this pointless suffering?
Verger shook her head pityingly.
Do you think a process so complex as recreating an entire planetary ecology can be entrusted to chance? No, Jason Solo. There is learning involved. Education, trial and error. More error than not, of course. And practice. Practice, practice, practice.
She opened a hand like a service droid offering a table in a fancy restaurant, indicating a large pond not far from the base of the hill where they stood. An island bulged from the pond's middle, a huge hulking mound of slick, waxy hexagonal blocks, like sealed birth chambers in a hive of Corellian wine bees. Except each of these chambers was large enough to swallow the Millennium Falcon. A ring of Yuuzhan Vong warriors circled the pond, facing outward with weapons at the ready, as though to defend it against unexpected attack. Another ring of warriors held the shore of the central island itself. Dozens or hundreds of shapers clambered among the blocks, bearing bundles and implements and jiggling sacks of liquid. Those huge hexagonal blocks must contain some sort of living creatures, something already huge, perhaps the pupil forms of unimaginable giants.
What are they?
he breathed. The real issue is not so much what they are, as what the single one that survives to maturity will become. Like all complex creatures, she said, the Yuuzhan Vong homeworld will require a brain. The creatures were called Duryams. Related to Yamasks, Duryams are fully as specialized as the giant war coordinators, but bred for a different, much more complex type of telepathic coordination. Bigger, stronger, vastly more powerful, Duryams are capable of mentally melding many, many more disparate elements than the greatest Yamask that ever lived. A Duryam will be responsible for integrating the activities of the Vong-forming organomachines. The Duryam will be less a servant than a partner, fully intelligent, fully aware, capable of making decisions based on a constant data flow streaming in from the entire planet-wide network of telepathically linked creatures to guide the planet's transformation flawlessly, without any of the chaotic system fragility that plagues natural ecologies. When Vergère had finished describing them, Jason said slowly, "These slave gangs, you're saying they're being mentally controlled?" Vergère nodded. "Here the Duryams hone their skills of mental mastery and the coordination of many disparate life forms that one of them will later use as the world brain." "One of them," Jason echoed. "Only one. The games these children play are more than serious. They are deadly. These infant Duryams know already the basic truth of existence. Win or die."
"It's so..." Jason's fists clenched helplessly. "So horrible."
"You will be astonished, I think, when you discover just how wrong you are." Jason looked away. "You're wasting your time, Vergère. I have nothing to learn from this place." "You see? Doubly mistaken. My time is not wasted, nor is this your schoolroom." She lifted her hand, a flickering blurred gesture, and the two warriors at Jason's back seized his arms in grips hard as hull metal. "This is your new home," she said, and stabbed him in the chest. Jason saw Vergère coming, a small, agile silhouette in the misty green gloom that passed for night in the nursery. He looked down again at the wound in the slave's belly, a long, curved gash, not too deep. "You'll be all right. From now on, stay away from the Ampistaff Grove." Jason glanced back up at Vergère. She was closer now, weaving through the fungal colony mounds of young ooglets. He hadn't seen her since his first day in the nursery. That had been, by his best estimate, weeks ago. Possibly months. "Try to keep it dry," Jason told the slave quietly. "And don't go anywhere near the Ampistaff Grove until it heals. I'm pretty sure they can smell wounds. They'll cut you to ribbons." This Ampistaff Grove was very different from the one he had found on the world ship at Merkur. Those had been shaped, altered, domesticated, tamed. The Ampistaff Grove in the nursery was the original, the baseline. Nothing about it was tame. The Ampistaff polyps in this grove range from 1 to 3 meters tall, deep-rooted mounds of leather-fleshed tissue, each with 2 to 5 muscular nodules from which sprouted triads of juvenile ampistaffs. Ampistaff polyps are sessile carnivores. The juvenile ampistaffs act as the polyps' arms and weapons, spearing, envenoming, and eventually dissecting a polyp's prey into chunks small enough to be swept into the polyp's fist-sized ground mouth. They will kill and eat any living thing. Only the Von Doon crab, the Ampistaff polyp's sole natural enemy, can approach them in safety, protected by the shallow curve of their impenetrable top shell.
But if I'm sent, the slave moaned, what then?
The slave seed web is only hooked into your touch pain nerves. The worst it can do is cause pain, Jason said. The amphistaffs will kill you.
But the pain! The pain!
I know. Jason rose, looking away toward Vergere. You'd better get some sleep. They'll turn the sun back on soon. Muttering, the slave dragged himself away, moving toward the rest of the slaves. He didn't say thanks. They rarely did. Vergere picked her way among the sleeping slaves. She looked up and met his eye, smiling, and gave a flickering wave with one hand. Jason said, "What do you want?" She got that wise smile and opened her mouth as if she was about to give one of her cryptic non-answers. But instead, she shrugged, sighed, and the smile faded.
"I am curious," she said plainly. "How is your chest?"
Jason touched his robe skin over the suppurating hole below his ribs. His robe had healed weeks ago. Even the bloodstain was gone.
"Do you feel it yet?"
Jason had stared down at the sluggish trail of blood that leaked from the hole below his ribs. The hole had been no bigger than the end of his little finger. Only then had Vergere told him what she had done. Implanted a slave coral seed inside his chest.
"I know you've been implanted before," she had told him. "On Belkadan, yes? That seed, though, grew too slowly and was removed too easily. So I've made your new improved one less accessible."
And the agony that had blossomed over his heart. The slave seed had sprouted in seconds, filaments wriggling like screwworms into his celiac plexus. It said hello by secreting algesic enzymes, triggering a star flare in his chest that slapped him off his feet like a blow from a club. He lay on the knotted hump of vein flesh, curled around his pain. The slave seed was linked telepathically to one of the Duryams. Whenever Jason wasn't doing what the Duryam wanted, the slave seed set his nerves on fire. The only way to escape pain was to discover the Duryam's desire. He'd try one thing after another until he found an activity that did not hurt. As it grew, its control refined. Through the increasingly sophisticated slave seed web, the Duryam could tell him to go forward by hurting his back. It could tell him to pick something up by hurting his empty hand. At need, it could spike his nerves so sharply that involuntary spasms would jerk an arm or a leg in the appropriate direction. The injection wound had gone bad, red and inflamed and crusted with yellow ooze. Jason stared expressionlessly at the alien avianoid creature who had inflicted this on him.
"My chest," he said. "It's all right."
She gathered her four opposable fingers into a point and jabbed firmly, accurately, through the robe skin onto his infected wound. Pain blazed in his side. Jason didn't even blink. She pointed to the ground.
"Lie down."
Jason sighed and lowered himself to the moss. Vergere seized his robeskin with both hands, then lowered her face to nip a hole in it with her small, sharp dental ridges. Jason watched her expressionlessly, not reacting to the coarse scrape across his inflamed ribs. She noted his regard and winked at him.
"Pain means little to you now, yes?"
"Since the embrace," Jason shrugged. "I don't ignore it, if that's what you mean." She lowered her head and closed her eyes, cupping the folded bandage in the palm of one hand. Jason stared, astonished, while she wept. Liquid gems gathered at the corners of her eyes and rolled down her muzzle, gleaming in the misty green twilight. Vergere mopped tears from her face with the crusted bandage, then applied that bandage once more to Jason's wound. His pain vanished.
"Hold this in place," she said.
And when Jason put his hand on the bandage, she began to tear strips from the lower edge of his robe skin. Jason couldn't stop himself from lifting the bandage. He had to see. The inflammation was gone. The skin around his wound was pink and healthy, and the wound itself dripped blood that looked and smelled normal, instead of the thick, death-reeking ooze of the infection that had leaked from it these many days.
Those tears. What are they? Jason asked, awed.
Whatever I choose them to be.
I don't understand.
If you still had the Force, it would be obvious. Females of my species have very sophisticated lacrimal glands. Even the Force blind could alter their tears to produce a wide range of pheromonal signals and chemical intoxicants for use on our males. Using the Force, my control is very precise. I can match the molecular structure of my tears to my desire, whether that desire be a systemic cure for Coombe spore infection or merely a potent topical antibiotic with instant steroidal properties.
Wow, Jason breathed, his heart stung with sudden hope. I mean, wow. Vergere, do you think, would you, could I? She gazed at him steadily.
Ask.
There are so many, he began. There's a slave, a Bothan, Trask. He shattered his ankle. Pelon Minor, he's human. He was the first one to find out that the amphistaph polyps in that grove over there are mature enough to attack. Peritonitis. He's dying.
Nothing you have said is a question or a request. Vergere blinked once, slowly, then again. Ask.
Your tears, Vergere. You could save so many lives.
Yes, I could.
Please, Vergere. Will you?
No.
Please.
No, Jason Solo. I will not. Why should I? They are slaves.
They're people.
Tell me this, Jason Solo. What distinguishes a flower from a weed?
Vergere.
This is not a riddle. What distinguishes a flower from a weed is only and exactly this. The choice of the gardener.
I'm not a gardener, Jason said, biting down on his temper. And these are not weeds.
She shrugged. Again, our difficulties may be linguistic. To me, a gardener is one who chooses what to cultivate and what to uproot. Who decides which lives must end so that the lives he cherishes may flourish.
You're the gardener, he muttered sullenly, staring at his hands. I'm just one of the weeds.
How is it, she asked slowly, that you have come to be the medical droid for your slave gang?
There's no one else who can do it.
The Duryam approves?
Let's say it took some convincing.
And how did you manage to convince it?
Jason stared through her, remembering his savage private struggle against the slave seed and the Duryam that controlled it, day after day of bitter agony. The Duryam was an intelligent creature. It had not taken long to discover that Jason could not be moved by pain. The turning point had come when the Duryam realized that it had been pouring so much energy and attention into its struggle with Jason that it was neglecting its other slaves. Its domain in the nursery was falling to ruin, becoming a wasteland among the lush domains of its sibling rivals, and it soon began to discover that Jason could be useful, even unbroken. Jason had taken every respite from the pain to minister to his fellow slaves. The Duryam had eventually seemed to understand that healthy slaves can work harder, and soon its domain began to improve again. But he said nothing of this. He owed Vergere no answers.
I told you before, he muttered solidly. You can kill me, but you can't make me obey. And that, Jason Solo, is why you are a flower among the weeds.
You're Sith, aren't you?
She went still. Am I?
I know a little about the dark side, Vergere. All this garbage about flowers and weeds, I know what you're really talking about. You're talking about believing you're above people.
Her first motion, a faint curve at the corners of her lips. Sith, Jedi, are these the only choices? Dark or light, good or evil? Is there no more to the Force than this?
Jason got up. I don't have time for this. They'll turn on the sun in a few minutes. He started walking toward the resting slaves. Vergier spoke to his departing back.
If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force?
What? Jason stopped. He looked over his shoulder.
What? You are born to be a gardener, she said. Remember this. It is not only your right to choose flowers over weeds. It is your responsibility. Which are flowers? Which are weeds? The choice is yours.
With a lightning crackle and a wavefront blast of thunder, the nursery's sun kindled overhead. Jason flinched, shading his eyes against the sudden flare. And by the time he could see again, Vergier was far away, hopping from hummock to hummock across the Von Dune crab bog. He stared after her.
If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force?
The question haunted him. Vergier could have been talking about his life. How could he live without the Force? The answer was, of course, that he couldn't. He didn't. The Force was there. He just couldn't feel it. Anakin used to say that the Force was a tool, like a hammer. If the Force is a hammer, Jason decided, then he was a carpenter with his arms cut off. He couldn't even see the hammer anymore. He couldn't remember what it looked like.
If I came of a species that had never had arms, I wouldn't recognize a hammer. And I'd have no use for it, even if I somehow guessed what it was. A hammer would have nothing to do with me at all. Like the Force has nothing to do with the Yuuzhan Vong.
That was half an answer, but the other half kept wriggling, chewing at the inside of his skull. Because the Force was not just a tool. There was a mystery here, one that nagged at him. Fortunately, he had plenty of time to think about it. As the days blended one into the next, the Duryam seemed to gain an understanding of what Jason did. Through the slave seed, the Duryam had sent occasional small, almost affectionate twinges, more like a pinch from a playmate than the crack of a slave master's whip. And Jason discovered that if he followed where these twinges directed him, he might find, say, a type of moss with immunostimulant properties, or a secretion of the Von Dune crabs that acted as a natural antiseptic. Almost as though the Duryam were trying to help.
If the Force is life, how can there be life without the Force?
The realization did not come as a blinding revelation, but rather as a slow dawning of awareness, an incremental gathering of comprehension. So that on a steel-colored noon, when he looked down from a hillock onto the Duryam Hive Island, he knew and understood and was neither surprised nor astonished at his new knowledge and understanding. This was what he knew and understood. The answer for the Yuuzhan Vong was the same as the answer for himself. There is no life without the Force. The human eye does not register electromagnetic energy outside the tiny band of frequencies called visible light. But even though you can't see them, those frequencies exist. The Yuuzhan Vong and their creations must participate in a part of the Force that is beyond the range of Jedi senses. That's all. Jason had always had a particular gift for making friends with alien species. He used to call it empathy. But it had always been more than shared emotion. It had been an improvised language that operated through a part of the Force that other Jedi didn't seem able to sense. Standing on the hillock, under the blue-white fusion ball noon, Jason began a cycle of breath that would ease his mind into Jedi focus. He reached down inside himself, feeling for the presence of the slave sea that was the Duryam's link to him. And his link to the Duryam. He felt it, where it coiled along his nerves, an alien animal sharing his body.
Hey there, little guy, he said inside himself.
Let's be friends. The View Spider stood on a spray of 9 slim-jointed legs that arched high from its central hub, before curving down to support its weight on grip-clawed feet. Below its central hub hung a transparent sack large enough to hold a Wookiee, filled to bulging with optical jelly. The central hub also held the View Spider's brain, which integrated telepathic signals channeled from a variety of the slave seeds that drove the creatures in the nursery. It integrated these signals into a holographic image created within the jelly medium by the intersection of phased electromagnetic pulses from a cluster of glands where the jelly sac attached to the brain hub. Noma Noor studied this image with a certain satisfaction, as did Vergere, who crouched on the chamber floor beyond the View Spider. The subject in question was Jason Solo.
"So," Noma Noor said, "you say the second step is complete. The Duryam has successfully seduced him?"
"Or he, the Duryam. It is the same. To create the empathic bond, as he has done, requires each of them to downplay their differences and focus on all they have in common. Yes, the second step is complete."
"So..."
Noma Noor leaned back and folded his long, bony fingers across his chest.
"Jason Solo has, for the moment, an alarming degree of freedom."
"Freedom is always alarming," Vergere agreed. Noma Noor waved this aside.
"Giving him room to act is one thing. Giving him that room in this ship is another."
"You believe he could threaten the ship? How?"
"I do not know. But I have not survived this much of the war by underestimating Jedi, particularly the Solo family. I am concerned. Even the slightest threat to this ship is far too great a risk."
He had no need to elaborate. Vergere knew already that the genetic material that had gone into the creation of the seed ship was irreplaceable. Gene samples preserved through the incalculable millennia of the Yuuzhan Vong's intergalactic voyage aboard the world ships. Samples preserved from a homeworld so long vanished in the dust of history that not even its name survived.
"Ease your mind, Noma Noor. Has not each step gone perfectly so far?"
He scowled.
"I distrust such easy victories. Leave me. Maintain your vigilance. In fact, intensify it. These last few days before seedfall will be especially dangerous. Take no chances."
"As you say, Executor."
Vergere favored him with a millimetrically correct bow, then opened the chamber's hatch sphincter and climbed out. And Noma Noor, in his cautious, methodical way, took his own advice. As soon as Vergere left, Noma Noor sent a message by Villip to the commander of a special detachment of warriors. This detachment had been brought aboard and specially trained for just such a moment as this. He issued a short string of orders. Before the end of the day, warriors in Ooglith maskers would begin to infiltrate the other slave gangs in the nursery. They would stay well away from Jason Solo, conceal their presence, and wait. When the Deveronian died, Jason thought, "Okay, maybe I was wrong." He knelt on the Hive Lake's verge. A mob of injured, wounded, and sick slaves surged and shouted around him, hands and tentacles and talons reaching for him, tugging at his robe skin. His robe skin had soaked up a lot of blood before Jason had managed to tourniquet the stump of the Deveronian's arm. The Deveronian's silver-based blood was black as tarnish and smelled of burned sulfur. From his link with the Duryam through the slave seed in his chest, Jason could faintly perceive his robe skin's primitive delight at the blood's unusual flavor. As weeks passed, Jason and the Duryam had learned to communicate more precisely through the medium of the slave seed.
He could now exchange information with the Duryam in the form of emotions and images. By using these in combination, they had developed a wide-ranging mutual vocabulary, but their connection had gone beyond this. At first, his own Duryam had tried to stop Jason from treating slaves who belonged to its sibling rivals. For nearly a day, Jason and the Duryam had gone back to their war of unendurable pain against unbreakable will. Through it all, Jason had kept hearing Vergere's voice echo inside his head. "Which are flowers? Which are weeds? The choice is yours." He had chosen. No agony at any Duryam's command could unmake his choice. There are no weeds here. Every slave was a flower. Every life was precious. He would spend the last erg of his strength to save every one of them. He had built an aid station near the bank of the lake that surrounded the Duryam Hive Island. His own Duryam had cooperated to the point of giving Jason the occasional help of a few members of his slave gang to gather medicinal mosses and herbs, supplies of clip beetles, and young robeskins that could be used for bandages. The Deveronian had been one of these temporary assistants. Jason had sent him upland for a bundle of grain-bearing grasses that grew on a nearby hillock. When ground fine, these grains made an excellent coagulant and were mildly antibiotic. Before he could return, the crowd of wounded had grown to a mob. The Deveronian had tried to skirt the mob by slipping around the Hive Pond shore, since the ring of Yuuzhan Vong warriors around it prevented the mob from extending in that direction. It was this that had killed him. He'd heard the harsh bark of a warrior's order at the edge of the pond, and he'd looked up in time to see a flicker of amphistaff blade conjure a jet of shimmering black blood. He had pushed and shoved and fought his way through the mob to find the Deveronian lying on his back in a scatter of the grasses he had carried, one hand clutching at the stump of his other arm. Jason had had time to gaze into the Deveronian's vivid red eyes, to read there a puzzled sadness at the useless, empty, arbitrary death that now swallowed him. That's when Jason thought, okay, maybe I was wrong. There were weeds here, after all. He lifted his head and met the eyes of a weed. The warrior who had killed the Deveronian returned his gaze impassively, black-smeared amphistaff at the ready. Expressionlessly, Jason rose and turned his back on the warrior and moved away into the mob. He'd decided who the weeds were. "You want gardening? Just wait. I'll show you gardening. Just you wait." A battered, barren world circled a blue-white spark of fusion fire. This world had seen the rise and fall of nation after nation, from simple provincial states to planetary confederations to interstellar empires and galactic republics. It had been the scene of a million battles, from simple surface skirmishes to the destruction of whole civilizations. It had been ravaged by war and reconstruction until its original environment survived only beneath sterile polar ice caps. It was the most artificial world of a galactic culture devoted to artifice. The whole planet had become a machine. This was about to change. Its new masters began by stealing its moons. Stripped from orbit by Dovin basal gravity drives, the three smaller moons were steered well away, while the largest was pulverized by tidal stress created by pulses from other Yamask-linked Dovin basals. A refined application of similar techniques organized the resultant mass of dust and gravel and lumps of hardening magma into a thick-spreading ring disk of rubble that rotated around the planet at an angle 17 degrees from the ecliptic. This, while dramatic in itself, was only a prologue. Dovin basals had been grown on the planet's surface. The effect of gravity can be profitably described topographically, as an altered curvature of space-time. The Dovin basals on the planet's surface altered the curve of local space-time in such a way that the direction of the planet's orbit became, roughly speaking, uphill. The planet slowed. Slowing, it fell inward toward its sun. It got warmer. Once the planet had spiraled into its revised orbit, the Dovin basals quieted, and space returned to its customary topography. The three remaining moons were moved back into new, more complex orbits, whose tidal effects would eventually braid the striated disk of rubble that ringed the planet into a permanent sky bridge of rainbow lace. By the time the seed ship fell back into normal space and moved toward an orbital intercept, the planet duplicated in its gross elements of orbital length, rotation, moons, and rings, the eon-lost homeworld of the Yuuzhan Vong. It remained only to remake the surface and bring life to the shattered remnants of what once had been a single planet-wide city, so that the planet could grow into the name it would bear. Yuuzhan Tar, the creche of God. Coruscant was ready for seedfall. In the nursery, it was the Tezopil Yunchilat, the day of comprehending the will of the gods. In these last few hours before seedfall, teams of shapers fanned out through the Duryam's domains, measuring, calculating, indexing, and evaluating. Each shaper team walked in company with a squad of towering, lanky warriors, heavily armored, weapons at the ready, glittering eyes scanning ceaselessly, moving with the ponderously sinister threat of reeks in mating season. Four squads guarded the Shri Yam Tees. A small, specialized subspecies of Yamisk, this speeder-sized creature existed only to emit a powerful interference signal in the telepathic band used by Yamisks and Duryams alike. The squads had carried the barrel-bodied Shri Yam Tees into the nursery in a huge basin filled with nutrient fluid. This was the first act of the Tezopil Yunchilat, because each Duryam knew that this was the day that would decide life or death. The Shri Yam Tees ensured that none of the Duryams could use its slaves for any desperate act of sabotage or self-defense. These slave seeds are designed with a failsafe. When telepathic contact with a Duryam is severed, each slave seed automatically immobilizes its slave by driving him mercilessly toward its parent, the coral tree basal from which slave coral was harvested. Shrieking sudden, inexplicable agony, the slaves scrambled for each domain's coral tree basal. Only actual physical contact with the coral tree basal could quiet a slave's pain. This organized the slaves into neat little clusters, keeping them safely out of the way until they could be most conveniently disposed of. Noma Noor glared at the image in the view spider's sack of optical jelly.
Why doesn't he do something?
Vergere shrugged liquidly and leaned to one side to get a better look through the view spider's thicket of legs.
He is doing something, just not what you expected.
The image in the optical jelly was barely more than a shadow in a twilight mist. The Shri Yam Tees blocked the view spider's image links along with the Duryam's control. To maintain its view of Jason Solo, it was forced to generate a shadow shape using the infrared-sensitive eye spots of the sessile polyps in the Amphistaff Grove.
Is he hiding? Is that it?
If so, he has picked the perfect spot.
The shadow of Jason Solo stood at the heart of the Amphistaff Grove.
And the polyps don't attack,
Noma Noor muttered, gnawing absently on the edge of one knuckle.
Perhaps he and the polyps have reached some understanding.
Abruptly, Noma Noor reached into a head-sized bubble den in the wall near his knee and grabbed a villip.
There is a slave in the Amphistaff Grove, he said into it. Pick him up, bind him, and return him to my coral craft.
The Villip whispered with a reply from the commander of Nomenor's Ooglith-masked warriors.
I hear and obey, Executor.
So...
Nomenor turned again to Vergère.
As you say, our solo project has progressed well. The nursery has served its purpose. You should be planning the next phase of his training. You'll want to continue as soon as he's safely aboard my coral craft.
My people, Nomenor, Vergère said meditatively, have a proverb about counting flitterflies when all one has is maggots.
Nomenor scowled.
What does that mean?
I believe, she nodded toward the viewspider's image sack, that you are about to find out.